next quote will speak on the effect of aerobic exercise on activities of daily living. Presenters are Lily Westbrook and Anthony Wilson Merritt.
Good morning, professors, clinical instructors, members of the community, and fellow students. This morning we will be presenting on our systematic review, which looked at the effects of aerobic exercise on activities of daily living post-stroke. I'd like to begin by introducing our group. We have Meredith, Kendra, Leah, Allison, Janine, and myself, Jessica, and we were supervised by Dr. Lara Boyd. Displayed here is an outline of our presentation. We will begin by introducing our topic, followed by reporting the methodology we used and the results we found. We will then highlight the main topics that came up in our discussion relating to participants, interventions, controls, and outcome measures. We will finish by reporting the conclusions that can be drawn from our systematic review and the clinical implications of these findings. So we will begin today by outlining some information on stroke, VO2, and the neuroprotective effects of aerobic exercise. Stroke, which is a blockage or bleed in the brain, represents one of the leading causes of morbidity. In Canada, over 50,000 people have a stroke per year, with 40% of individuals left moderately impaired and 10% are severely impaired. Resultant signs and symptoms, such as co-contraction and spasticity, can have a negative effect on one's ability to live daily life. Furthermore, stroke places a large economic burden on the Canadian healthcare system. In 2000, an estimated $2.8 billion was associated with this neurological condition. So for our review, our definition of aerobic exercise was the ability to perform large muscle, dynamic, moderate, to high intensity exercise for prolonged periods as per the ACSM. Moderate intensity aerobic exercise, such as walking, has been shown to decrease the risk of stroke in a dose response manner. It is postulated this is due to decreased blood pressure, decreased plasma fibrinogen and platelet aggregation, and increased HDL concentration. Post-stroke, individuals exhibit an extensive decrease in aerobic conditioning, resulting from the event itself and a subsequent decrease in physical activity. Furthermore, there is a decrease in the number of active motor units and oxygen capacity of parietic muscle, thus resulting in diminished VO2. Decreased aerobic fitness, coupled with increased energy demands, greatly affects individuals' ability to perform activities of daily living. For the purpose of this review, our definition of ADL was any task or action executed by an individual in their daily life, including grooming, eating, dressing, toileting, and transferring. So this brings us to VO2. Treadmill training decreases energy expenditure and cardiovascular demands of gait in individuals with stroke. VO2 is a contributing factor to independence. Literature states a VO2 max of at least 15 milliliters per kilogram per minute for women and 18 for men is required for independent living. Individuals with stroke who participated in an aerobic conditioning program had an average increase in VO2 of 13% compared to the control. Increased aerobic fitness has also been associated with functional gains, including increased mobility, decreased falls, and increased ability to carry out activities of daily living. Research indicates that aerobic exercise also has a neuroprotective effect and may subsequently influence neuroplasticity. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor appears to be the most sensitive to regulation via exercise. This may be of importance in mediating the benefits of exercise on neuroplasticity and central nervous system health. This is vital post-stroke, as neuroplasticity is required for neural reorganization and regeneration to occur in order to increase function. So why is this topic relevant to physical therapists? It is hoped this review will provide information to assist in clinical decision-making regarding the effectiveness of aerobic training in individuals post-stroke, thus ensuring that limited therapy resources are used effectively. Also, to help determine the type, duration, and intensity of aerobic activity that is most beneficial for those affected by stroke. So our research question for this review was, what is the effect of aerobic exercise training on the activities of daily living in individuals with stroke? Now, Allison will outline the methods conducted in our review.
Okay, so we defined our inclusion criteria as being studies that were written in English, that were randomized controlled trials, participants that had had a stroke who were medically stable enough to perform aerobic exercise, interventions that were aerobic that lasted a minimum of 4 weeks and participants engaged in the activity a minimum of 3 times per week, and finally that they also included a reliable and valid outcome measure for ADLs. Our exclusion criteria included participants involved in aerobic activity prior to study onset, as we wanted all the participants to be as much on a similar baseline at the start, as well as studies that used a combination of training, such as aerobic exercise and strength training, aerobic exercise and Tai Chi, as we were specifically looking at aerobic exercise. In terms of our search strategy, we ran it from September 2008 to January 2009, and we looked at the databases CINAHL, Embase, Medline, Unindex Medline, and SportsDiscus. We initially looked at PubMed, but we were unable to get full text articles from it, so that's why we used the Unindex Medline, as we were able to retrieve those articles in full text. In terms of our search strategy, we first screened the titles, then onto abstracts, and finally onto full text screen. This was done by 2 independent reviewers, and any discrepancies were resolved by discussion or a third reviewer. Hand searching was later done of the reference list of the included articles using the same criteria, looking at the titles, abstracts, and full text screen. Our quality assessment and data abstraction. For quality assessment, we use the Pedro Methodological Quality Assessment Scale, which is known to be valid and reliable. And we also used a data abstraction form, which we developed ourselves from a template provided by Darlene Reed. Again, both procedures were conducted by 2 independent reviewers, and discrepancies were resolved by discussion or a third reviewer. In terms of our data analysis, we originally hoped to do a meta-analysis, but due to the heterogeneity of our results, we had to perform a qualitative analysis. So these are the main reasons that we excluded studies from our review. If they had a multimodality intervention, so as I discussed before, including strength training and Tai Chi in the intervention, if they lacked a control group, if they lacked an aerobic intervention, if they had insufficient training frequency and duration, languages other than English. We actually found a number of articles in Mandarin that seemed from their abstract to be appropriate. However, we were unable to translate them and therefore unable to use them. And finally, another reason for exclusion was the absence of a reliable and valid outcome measure.
Okay, so moving on to the results section of our presentation. This is a flowchart of our selected studies. So initially, we found over 1,000 articles. We did a title screen of these articles and narrowed it down to 189. Then we looked at the duplicates between the different databases, which brought it down to 143. After doing an abstract screen, we were left with 40 articles. After full text screen, we were left with 4. Then upon hand searching, we found 3 additional articles and had 7 included. Now initially, we had MS and Parkinson's disease as part of our research questions. However, there was no Parkinson's studies found and only 1 MS study, so we thought it would be a more thorough and narrow review if we only looked at stroke. So that left us with 6 studies. Of these 6 studies, the Katz-Lehrer and colleague study looked at the same data set. It was just 2 different articles, so there was only 5 original data sets. So we had 1 study that used a cyclergometer, 3 that used a treadmill, and 1 that used a gait trainer. Outcome measures included the Frenchy Activity Index, the Nottingham, the Stroke Impact Scale Domain 5, the Rivermead Mobility Index, the Functional Independence Measure, and the Barthel Index. Quality assessment scores range from 5 to 9 on the PAGRO scale. So this is a table of our demographic info of the different studies. So as you can see, the age range was quite large. The mean ages ranged from the late 50s to the late 70s, and where reported, the range was actually all the way down to the 20s and into the 70s, so it was quite a large range of ages. Then looking at the next two columns of the number of participants, you can see that Pohl's study had a large sample size of 72, and Katzler and colleagues had fairly large sample sizes of about 45 in each group, whereas Liston, Macko, and Smith had much smaller sample sizes of 8, 20, and 10 in each group. So there was also a wide variety of type of stroke. The majority were ischemic strokes. And then the time post-stroke ranged from less than 60 days in Pohl's study to less than 2 years in Smith's study, and some studies did not specify the time since stroke. So looking at Kessler's study first, they used leg cyclogometer training. They had two phases. The first phase was 2 weeks long. They exercised for up to 20 minutes continuous, 5 days a week. And then in the second phase, it was 6 weeks long, and they exercised 30 minutes 3 times a week. They exercised an intensity of 60% of heart rate reserve. The control group received regular therapy 5 days a week. Now, regular therapy in this study included PT, OT, and SLP as required. And the outcome measures they looked at were the Frenchy Activity Index and the Functional Independence Measure. So they looked at FAI scores pre-stroke retrospectively and at 6 months follow-up, and found that the total score decreased 10 points in both the control and intervention groups, which suggests that both groups were left with functional deficits. Now, they didn't look at a pre- and post-intervention score for the Frenchy Activity Index, which is quite different than some of the other studies. So we're unable to tell from this whether the intervention had a direct result on the Frenchy Activity Index. They did find that those with more severe strokes showed greater improvements. Now, in the other Katzler article, they did look at pre- and post-stroke results, and they found a trend towards improvement in all parameters of functional ability in the experimental group. However, specifically for the FIM, they found no statistical difference. Now, for Liston's study, they used a treadmill for training. They walked as long as was comfortable, with rest breaks as needed for up to 60 minutes, 3 times a week for 6 weeks. The control group received conventional physiotherapy, and the outcome measure used was the Nottingham. Now, the conventional physio for this intervention had 31 interventions that included gait ignition failure, balance, and postural reactions. They found no significant difference between groups. Moving on to Macko and colleagues' study, they also used a treadmill. They walked at 40 minutes 3 times a week for 6 months. They started at 40 to 50% of heart rate reserve and increased heart rate reserve by 5% every 2 weeks and increased the time by 5 minutes every 2 weeks as tolerated by the patients. The control group had 40 minutes of stretching and 5 minutes of low intensity treadmill walking 3 times a week for 6 months. And the outcome measure used was the Rivermead Mobility Index. Again, Macko's study found no difference between groups. Now for Pohl and colleagues' study. They used a gait trainer, which was different than the other interventions. They had up to 20 minutes on the gait trainer plus 25 minutes of conventional physio, 5 days a week for 4 weeks, and they progressed by decreasing body weight support. The control group had 45 minutes of conventional physio, and they concentrated on the restoration of stance and gait. Now, this study we did have a combination of the gait trainer plus conventional physio. However, because they were being compared to the control group, which also was getting conventional physio, if there was a difference between groups, it could be attributable to the 20 minutes on the gait trainer. They looked at the Barthel Index and the Rivermead Mobility Index. So Pohl's study found significant differences for both the Barthel and the Rivermead, with this experimental group doing better than the control group. Okay, now for Smith's study, they had sessions for 4 weeks, 3 times a week, and they had 20 minutes of walking with unlimited rest breaks. They increased by 0.2 miles per hour, and once they achieved 10 minutes of continuous, oh, sorry, they increased 0.2 miles per hour once they got to 10 minutes of continuous. They went at a self-selected velocity and had to stay below 13 on a 20-point Borg scale. The control only filled out quality of life logs, and the outcome measure was the stroke impact scale domain 5. They had a trend towards increased ADL function in the experimental group, but it was not statistically significant. So we created a graph of percent change over time of the different studies just to get a little bit more of a visual effect of our results. So there's six columns in some of the studies. The first two columns are just during the study period, and the last four are for follow-up. So Smith and Pohl were the only ones who collected follow-up data, so they're the only ones with the extra columns. The first two columns represent the percent change from initial till final. The second two columns represent percent change from final to follow-up, sorry, initial to follow-up. And the last two columns represent the difference from final to follow-up. So as you can see, all the studies except for Liston's had a greater percent change in the experimental group for the initial to final time period. Then looking to Smith and Pohl for the follow-up results, from initial to follow-up, in both studies, the experimental group had a greater percent change. And then looking at the last two columns from final to follow-up, you can see that in Smith's study, the experimental group did better than the control group. However, in Pohl's study, you can see that once the intervention was discontinued, the experimental group didn't improve more than the control group. So based on the five data sets in the systematic review, there was no patterns of improvement in ADLs found. So moving on to the discussion now.
All right, so our discussion is arranged in a format that some of you may find familiar. We're going to discuss the effects that the participants, the interventions, the control groups, and the outcome measures had on the null results of our systematic review. As far as the participants go, there is high variability among participants across studies. Primarily, we saw variability among severity of stroke, so how much functional deficit the participants were left with. The participants in Pohl's study were the most severely affected. They had to be non-ambulatory and or ambulating with 1 to 2 person assist. However, all the other studies required their participants to be ambulatory. Pohl was the only study that found significant results, so we decided that this is probably a key factor. Katz-Lehrer et al. Also found an interaction effect between event severity, the French Activity Index score, and the intervention in favor of those more severely affected. However, this was merely an observation. He didn't have any numbers to back this up. So because of this, research shows that participants are likely to have a lower VO2 max due to deconditioning post-stroke, and thus they probably had more to gain from an aerobic intervention. So one of our conclusions is that aerobic activity is likely more important in increasing ADL function in those who have suffered greater functional deficits from stroke. However, additional research is needed as we only have one study that showed significant results and one which is just an observation. The other area where participants differed is in type and location of stroke and also time post-stroke. Different areas of stroke could have different results, and damage to different areas of the brain can cause increased functional deficits, and therefore may require more treatment time to return to pre-stroke functional levels. And regarding post-stroke study entry time, individuals entering rehab earlier have a larger window for recovery. A good example for this in our systematic review is Pohl's study again, where participants were less than 60 days post-stroke, and while they did not account for spontaneous recovery, this study, as mentioned before, was the only one to show significant improvements in ADLs. The other problem encountered was small sample sizes. We believe these contributed to lack of significant results, as sample sizes ranged from 8 to 72 participants in each group. And again, Pohl is our all-star study, mm-hmm. and had 72 participants in each group. So moving on to the intervention now. We believe that this is probably the single most important factor contributing to our null results. There was a great deal of heterogeneity of exercise dose across the studies included in our review. ACSM recommends that an intervention last for 15 to 20 weeks to show a training effect. And we could not find any research in stroke population for this number. Therefore, we would recommend that interventions last at least this long, as this is the most evidence-based guideline available to our knowledge. So regarding intervention time, Mako et al. Had the longest study period at 6 months. However, they had no significant findings. We believe this is due to other factors, however. Mako et al. Used the River Mead Mobility Index. This is a dichotomous ADL scale relating specifically to basic mobility. Therefore, patients are rated on can they perform the task or can they not perform the task. And because the participants in Mako et al.'s study were initially ambulatory with only mild to moderate gait deficits, we're presuming that a ceiling effect may have occurred with this outcome measure, because Pohl et al. Used the same outcome measure, and his participants were initially non-ambulatory, but he showed significant results with a p less than 0.001. So we surmise that the same ceiling effect that we believe Mako reached isn't evident in Pohl's study. Intensity is a big issue also in our systematic review. The ACSM says that to achieve cardiorespiratory benefits from training, an intensity of 40 to 50 all the way to 85% of heart rate reserve is required in healthy individuals to show a training effect. Two studies use the heart rate reserve to measure intensity. One used Borg's rating of perceived exertion, and the others did not report any intensity measure. Therefore, we are unable to determine if intensity was sufficient enough in all of our studies to produce a training effect according to the ACSM guidelines. Another thing relating to the intensity is rest breaks. There are two studies, Liston and Smith, who allowed unlimited rest breaks for their participants, and the number and duration of these rest breaks were not documented or accounted for. And again, the ACSM says that 10 minutes of continuous aerobic exercise is required in a healthy individual for a training effect. However, since the rest breaks were not documented, we're unable to determine if these 10 minutes were actually accrued in those studies.
So in addition to the participant and intervention factors that Kendra just discussed, the type of control group therapy may have contributed to the lack of significant findings. There was a large variability in the control group therapy. Three of the control groups participated in walking activities. This is important as four of the five studies used walking as their aerobic intervention. This may have hindered the amount of detectable change between groups, even though the control group walking may have been at a lower dose that was not considered aerobic under the ACSM guidelines. ACSM guidelines are designed for healthy individuals. So some of the control therapies may have been aerobic for some of the individuals as deconditioning is observed post-stroke. Smith found a trend in favor of the intervention group. The control group used solely quality of life logs, and so there was no aerobic component to their therapy. It is likely that the individuals in other studies who received conventional physiotherapy would benefit from other training stimuli that would improve their ADLs. However, it may be more pertinent to compare aerobic exercise to conventional physiotherapy in order to determine if aerobic exercise should be incorporated as part of a conventional physiotherapy program. In terms of outcomes, the specificity of outcome measures likely contributed to the lack of significant findings in the majority of studies. In these studies, there is little specificity with regards to the intervention and the ADL task being measured. Three studies chose ADL measures that were not closely related to the intervention, and all had insignificant findings. Pohl was the only study to report a statistically significant difference on their ADL measures, which were both mobility related. The River Mead score showed a greater percent change than the Barthel Index, presumably because it only included mobility measures, whereas the Barthel Index included measures of self-care. Due to the lack of specificity between the intervention and ADL measures, future studies should include ADL measures that are more specific to the aerobic intervention. However, this finding takes away from the generalizability of aerobic exercises on ADL function. Perhaps aerobic exercise training with the lower limbs only affects mobility-related ADLs and not upper extremity ADLs. However, improved mobility may allow individuals to practice upper extremity ADLs more frequently, thereby indirectly improving overall ADLs.
So there are some limitations to our review. It highlighted the lack of primary evidence to support aerobic exercise for improving ADLs in individuals with neurological conditions. As previously stated, this lack of studies resulted in a narrowing of the study question to include only individuals with stroke. Furthermore, the study question had to be made initially broad in order to find enough articles to justify the systematic review. As a consequence, there was high heterogeneity in the participants, methods, outcome measures, and quality of the studies we found. And so the ability to compare the trials was limited. The resultant review was therefore descriptive instead of meta-analytical. Another limitation was that the included studies were restricted to those published in English. This may have further reduced the number of studies that were accepted into the review. As well, authors were not contacted to retrieve unpublished data. And there was a reason for this. While unpublished data may provide additional details, the data would be less reliable as it may not have been peer-reviewed. These limitations do, however, provide the drive for future research, which can aid to overcome the flaws mentioned above.
So there are several conclusions that can be made from our systematic review. To begin, adequate dose must be achieved to see changes in activities of daily living post-stroke. However, higher quality and more specific studies are required to determine a dose-response relationship for aerobic exercise post-stroke and to find patterns among studies. In addition, outcome measures must be specific to the intervention to be most sensitive to change. Finally, from our systematic review, it is apparent more studies need to be conducted on the effects of aerobic exercise in activities of daily living in individuals with other neurological conditions, such as multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease. This will allow us to determine if physiotherapy should include aerobic exercise in the treatment of individuals with these conditions. This leads us to the clinical implications that can be drawn from our systematic review. To begin, as limited evidence suggests that aerobic exercise has positive effects on activities of daily living in non-ambulatory individuals post-stroke, we would encourage therapists to consider including aerobic exercise in the treatment of these populations more severely affected by stroke. In addition, aerobic exercise should be used in conjunction with conventional physiotherapy, as there is limited evidence to support its use in improving activities in daily living in individuals post-stroke. Lastly, individuals post-stroke must persist with an aerobic exercise program to continue to see changes in activities of daily living. I would now like to take the opportunity to acknowledge, on behalf of our group, several individuals who helped to assist us throughout our systematic review. To start, we'd like to thank Darlene Reed and Elizabeth Dean for organizing the program and the support they provided over the year. We'd also like to thank Charlotte Beck for the many hours that she assisted us with our search strategy. And lastly, many thanks to Lara Boyd for being our supervisor and assisting us throughout the entire process. Without all of you, we wouldn't have been able to accomplish what we have, so thank you. These are the references that we used. And I'd now like to open up the floor for discussion.
Questions?
Yes.
As you said, there were several different outcome measures that were used by the different studies, and I think you commented a little bit on the differences between them, but I was just wondering if maybe you could comment just on any major comparisons between them, what types of ADLs were included in most of them?
Yep. I'll just refer to this. So the FIM, the Functional Independence Measure, had 18 items, which were scored 1 to 7, with 7 being more independent. They looked at things like self-care, sphincter control, mobility, locomotion, communication, and psychosocial and cognitive aspects. And the Frenchy Activity Index had 15 items, scored 1 to 4, again 4 being more independent. Rates, frequency of preparing meals, washing up, housework, shopping, social outings, etc. Rivermead Mobility Index had 15 mobility-related items, and like Kendra said, it was a yes, no, can they do it type of scale. Nottingham had 22 items that were mobility, kitchen, domestic tasks, and leisure activities. And Barthel Index, I think most people are probably familiar with this one, had 10 items scored out of 100. And again, looked at feeding, grooming, bathing, dressing, bowels, bladder, etc. And Stroke Impact Scale Domain 5 was activities that you might do in a typical day.
So would you say that the outcome measure should then be more like mobility related ADLs as opposed to like more upper extremities?
So that's what referred to. So definitely there's going to be like a greater effect if the intervention and the ADL are both mobility related. However, that's not like saying much to like grooming activities where you're using more of your arms.
Yeah.
But like Meredith said, if you have more mobility, you can get around more and you have more opportunity to practice the upper extremity ADLs. So it's kind of an indirect effect.
What reasons did Paul give for their significant findings in the experimental group? I think you mentioned VO2 max possibly. Did they measure that, or was there more to it besides VO2 max?
I think so.
I know that you guys discussed a few things like on your own, but I was just wondering if they had any ideas themselves.
Like Pohl had a really large sample size compared to the other studies, and they also had the combination of aerobic and conventional physio, which might be more beneficial than aerobic exercise alone. And they also, they had 20 minutes of continuous, so they didn't have rest breaks like some of the other studies did, so we know that they probably achieved the aerobic like, definition.
You mentioned that VO2 max needs to be 15 and 18 for male, female for doing activities of daily living. I was just wondering if anywhere they mentioned that what VO2 max people post-stroke are residing around. Was that ever measured or mentioned?
It's not so much measured within the articles that we looked at, but certainly on a general scale of some of the background searching that we've done, they do start at a much lower level. So there is still the question of whether or not a person post-stroke is actually capable of achieving an aerobic level, or whether or not they're achieving the aerobic levels at a lower amount, because they're using more oxygen, for just their regular movements, more so than what you or I would.
I think it depends on the severity of the stroke and what areas of the body is affected as well as what time post-stroke you're looking at them, if you're looking at them immediately post-stroke or if you're looking at them 2 months down the road and what activities they've done since then. So I think that those all play major factors in determining that.
Were you guys surprised with your results?
A little bit, yeah. But there was a lot of like study design flaws, which might have accounted for some of that. Alex?
I kind of have a two-part question, but the second part hinges on the first. I wasn't familiar with all of the outcome measures that you use, and it sounded like there was a bit of an international flavor to them. So were they just used within, say, North America, or were your studies from around the world?
We had some in Israel, Germany, the States.
Okay.
So all over the place.
Based on that, and through reading the articles yourselves, do you guys think that it's plausible that the acute management of the stroke itself, or whatever sort of CVA they had, may play a role in the outcome of these studies because certain areas of the world may not have certain medications or certain immediate surgical procedures like cerebral decompressions or things like that, that may affect how much recoverability there is within that patient? Is that plausible, or what are your comments on that?
I think it may be plausible, but there were still initial requirements for participants to be included in studies. So they did have to be ambulatory, which means they either had a mild stroke or didn't have those surgical interventions that you're talking about,
or that they maybe they had a more severe stroke and medicine was able to intervene and help them rehab, I guess, to the point of being ambulatory. So I think it may have played a small role, but I think because of the inclusion criteria of the participants, that maybe it's not as big as that.
I think also because they measure pre and post, whatever they did before that is might not be as relevant because they still are measuring like what are they when they started the intervention and what was it at the end. So their initial acute recovery might not be as relevant.
I was just wondering if any of the studies reported severity of stroke besides just being ambulatory or non-ambulatory. Did they like show the stages or anything like that?
Some of them did the SSS, Scandinavian stroke scale, I think. Some of them used like different measures to like see between groups to make sure that the groups were the same initially, so they definitely did measure the severity of the stroke.
But I think when we're saying severity of stroke, we're thinking more of it on a functional level because our outcome measure was ADLs.
Yeah.
So.
I know that you did recommend to include aerobic exercise into our PT treatments of people post-stroke, but in saying that, faced with the typical time restrictions that are or just fatigability with stroke patients. Do you guys believe as a result of this review that you would recommend spending time on aerobic exercise or would it better be spent elsewhere? Like in other mechanisms that have also been more effective?
I think if you could approach it kind of by breaking it down, maybe not thinking so much aerobic at this point because the evidence is very limited, but more thinking more again of doing the activities that like walking, you can still walk, but at a level that isn't necessarily aerobic to work themselves up to that and gains. Because a lot of these individuals will also present with postural instability and fatigue, muscle weakness, etc. So really addressing all of those in a multifactorial approach would be the best. So really combining it in adjacent with the conventional physiotherapy, but having it more starting to approach those activities, realizing that they may or may not be able to actually achieve an aerobic level at this point.
We also went into the literature a little bit more and found some great literature on the effects of exercise. So it actually enhances a neurotrophic factor called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and that's enhanced with exercise, and that can help with recovery after stroke. So that, again, is a good, helps plead our case why exercise is really important to incorporate in.
I was just interested more in the differentiation between exercise and, you know, trying to reach that aerobic level. But you answered it.
Okay.
Clarify again, to establish that heart rate reserve, was that based on a maximum test in most studies? Was that your inclusion criteria? Was that they had a maximum test?
No.
Most of the studies that did include heart rate reserve, they did do a maximum test, though. I think there was only two studies.
Just two studies. Can you clarify the difference, the gender difference, for what was recommended for an optimal VO2 to be able to perform activities of daily living?
So it was 15 for females and 18 for males, and that was a VO2 required for independent living. It wasn't specifically for ADL.
But then the question again, why the difference?
So it might be higher in males just because they have a higher like body mass to move around. Like the body composition of males and females are quite different as well, so that might account for some of the difference.
But it is adjusted for weight. So it's a little curious. Anybody like to comment on that?
Maybe due to like some of the tasks that are required. Like maybe not so much anymore, but more traditionally, maybe a lot of the tasks that a female might have done at home would have been like a lower requirement, and for males maybe higher if they were outside working.
Yeah, sort of gender differences. Body composition, gender differences. Based on what you've learned from this review, how would you design a study to address this question?
Well, Macro's study was actually a really good design. It scored a 9 on the Pedro scale. I think the reason that Macro didn't show any significant results was that ADLs was not his primary question. His primary question was more mobility. He was looking at 6-minute walk test, measures like that, less the ADL. I think ADL he kind of tacked on the end for something extra. And like I mentioned previously, that's the dichotomous scale, and I think that a ceiling effect was reached. And so Macro's study was great. It was long, it was 6 months. He had relatively high sample size. But yeah, I'd probably copy that and just pick a different
say. Do you have reason to believe that in the general population, and let's assume that people with who have had a stroke are deconditioned, and that's actually a bit debatable, but let's base it on the assumption. Is there reason to believe in the generally deconditioned population that they're not as able to perform their activities of daily living as those who are less deconditioned or conditioned?
I think it probably depends on which activities of daily living, but I definitely think for a lot of them, for somebody that's very deconditioned, getting up to go to the bathroom might be very, very difficult for them. So I think that aerobic exercise would definitely help some people in the general population if they're severely deconditioned.
Yeah. Typically in the general, often that's coupled with comorbidity or some morbidity, right? So if we're really looking at people who are basically no limitation of body structure and function, and look at those people, and I'd actually be hard-pressed to actually anticipate that that would be associated. But, I think that that's an unanswered question for the moment. Another point is, and this is something I always come back to when I get a little vigilant when I think about aerobic exercise in this group, because of the musculoskeletal issues, the spasticity, the poor movement efficiency. And do you have any sense of when you separate out just practice, motor planning, the capacity to, with practice, to perform a task more efficiently, therefore, if your musculoskeletal efficiency goes up, your movement economy improves, right? So you're having to put in, it requires the energy cost is reduced. Do you have any sense of, did any of the studies sort of factor that in at all? Because we tend to like to take what the normal kind of VO2, and we can't always make that assumption. And I think you made reference to that. Mm-hmm. But was that addressed, the movement efficiency issue, and practice makes perfect?
I don't think it was addressed in any of the particular studies, but I think that is probably why we saw interventions that were related closely to the ADL measures. That's probably why we saw a significant result there, is because they're practicing it. And we definitely can't rule that out as a factor.
And I think a couple of questions from the audience were right on, and that is, what kind of ADL activities are we really talking about? Mm-hmm. Because it's things to do with the arm versus mobility. When we think of aerobic exercise, we tend to think of whole body. Mm-hmm. And if you factor out that mobility part, is it in fact that they've been enabled to do their upper extremity better? I think I had one more question. That's escaped me. Right. Oh, it hasn't. I'm a little. One of the things I think about is what I've read is that it takes often up to 2 years before you really get a stable baseline. You were quite close in many respects in terms of what was accepted in terms of time after stroke. And I'm just wondering, with spontaneous improvement with time, how much do you think that may have? It really wasn't controlled in some sense.
No, it wasn't controlled. I think it definitely helped the participants in the studies. But then you get the question, if you add physio while that spontaneous recovery is occurring, hopefully you're going to end up better than spontaneous recovery on its own without physio.
Well, that's the assumption, isn't it? But we don't really know that. And that's a huge contaminant. We have to show that we're better than spontaneous improvement with time, or to have a stable baseline, and then to show change.
Yeah, and I just the question regarding efficiency, you know, at the end of the day, are you going to do this? You've got X number of patients to see in a day. Are you going to focus on function, or are you going to, does this look like kind of, well, it's a nice to, but not as essential? In answering that question with respect to the preventative effect of aerobic exercise, what would you say, does it have a role, does it not have a role in this cohort?
For prevention of stroke?
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
absolutely. Yes. And I think that is a very, very important question, but it comes down also, the greatest risk of having a stroke is the fact that you've had one before.
Mm-hmm.
Or that you're going to have the other complications of high blood pressure, that you're going to have a myocardial infarction. All those things are increased. So the protective effects, and sometimes we forget about that as a protective mechanism, but it actually, we can, I think, make justification for including it as a priority.
Yeah.
Just along those same lines, I'm just wondering if any of the studies reported any adverse effects, such as subsequent strokes or anything?
Yeah, studies did. Sorry. Go for it. Okay. They did report adverse events. I don't remember stroke being one, but I do remember there was MIs.
Mm-hmm. There was up to 9 dropouts was the most in one of the groups, but the majority of our studies, there was one that had none, and then the rest were around 3 or 4, but were typically quite similar both on the intervention and the control.
And that's a very germane question, but the fact that it happened during this program, is it really attributed to the program, or would it have happened anyway?
Yeah.
When they look at patients who've been in cardiac rehabilitation programs or stress testing, maximal exercise testing, yeah, they have their proportion of people who drop dead some fairly serious effects, but actually that's no greater than in the general population for that same cohort. So I think that's important. Okay, no further questions. Thank you very much.